I'm going to present results from a study where we looked at latent classes of injection risk behavior in a cohort of young injection drug users, and also the differential effects of HIV prevention intervention by risk class. This is a secondary data analysis. So this data comes from the third collaborative injection drug users study. And the study, over 3,000 young injection drug users were recruited in five cities. And in order to be eligible for the intervention, they had to be HIV and HCV antibody negative. And the drug users intervention trial tested a peer education intervention against a time attention control. So over 1,500 trial eligible baseline participants showed up to get their test results and were invited to participate in this compromise or baseline sample. And this study was funded by the CDC, and it was a cooperative at five sites. So we collected information on injection risk behavior at baseline, sharing syringes, sharing other injection equipment, cooker's cotton and rinse water, cleaning syringes with bleach, and using a new sterile syringe when splitting drugs, and the number of partners with whom they shared needles. So the measures of safe behavior were reversed to reflect unsafe behavior, and all the measures were recoded into three categories. So they were coded so that to indicate never engaging in risky behavior, or engaging in risky behavior less than half the time, or engaging in risky behavior half the time or more. And number of syringe sharing partners was categorized into none, one, or more than one. And then we conducted a latent class analysis. And this is basically similar to a factor analysis, but instead of an underlying continuous variable, we're looking for an underlying categorical variable. And for output, rather than getting a factor score on a continuous latent variable, you get probabilities for each class. Latent class analysis is also known as finite mixture modeling. It assumes that the observed distribution is the result of a mixture of different distributions. And the aim is to identify the underlying latent classes or unobserved subgroups. So the first step was to run the latent class analysis with different numbers of classes. So we ran models with 2 to 6 classes and looked at the fit indices. And it's clear that we have at least 4 classes and maybe 5. So we started by looking at the 4-class model. And the 4-class model included a low-risk group with very little risk behavior, an equipment sharing class with little to no needle sharing risk, a moderate risk class with infrequent sharing of syringes, and a high risk class with frequent sharing of syringes and or equipment. High risk participants endorsed on average 4 high frequency risk behaviors and 1 or 2 low frequency risk behaviors. Moderate risk participants endorsed on average 4 low-frequency behaviors and 1 or 2 high-frequency behaviors. I should point out that on this graph, the solid lines represent high-frequency behaviors, and the dashed lines represent low-frequency behaviors. So low-frequency is being risky less than half the time, and high-frequency is being risky half the time or more. The 5-class model split the equipment sharing class into a low frequency and high frequency sharing class, comprising 12% and 9% of the sample. We decided that that distinction was probably not going to be very useful, and we proceeded with the 4-class model, which had very good classification quality. In general, an entropy measure of 0.8 or greater is considered good. And the average most likely class probabilities were all above 0.9, and which means that when people are classified into their most likely class, the probability of belonging to that class is very high. So there's not a lot of doubt about which class they belong to. So at in the baseline sample, 1/3 of the sample fell into the low-risk group, 27% in the high-risk group, 21% in the equipment-sharing group, and 18% in the moderate-risk group. The large proportion of low-risk users might be a reflection of the organizations that recruited the participants, which are focused on harm reduction, needle exchange, and so on, but also raises an issue in the context of testing and intervention. Having a large number of participants with little or no risk behavior may decrease the power of the study. So next, we assigned participants to their most likely class based on the probabilities and looked at some correlates of class membership. Women were more likely to be in the high-risk group. Whites were more likely to be a high risk, and while blacks and Hispanics were more likely to be low risk. The class distribution was similar across cities, although Baltimore had a larger proportion of high risk participants. And class was correlated with frequency of injection and number of injections done with others. In terms of proportions of injections, high-risk injectors injected with others about 60% of the time, while low-risk injectors injected with others about 27% of the time. Injection risk class was also correlated with peer norms for safer injecting. Here, higher scores indicate peer norms more favorable to safer injection. So clearly, those who are in the low-risk group have peer norms that are favorable for safer injection. And class is also correlated with safer injection self-efficacy. ¼% of the baseline eligible participants were randomized to an intervention condition to participate in the peer education or control groups. And intervention trial participation did not vary by injection risk class. So high-risk participants were equally willing to participate in the trial as low-risk participants. So 854 participants in the trial were randomized to a condition. Peer education participants attended 6 small group sessions to teach risk reduction and peer education skills. And control participants also attended 6 small group sessions where they watched videos and had discussions about social issues. Participants were then interviewed at 3-month and 6-month follow-ups. 712 participants completed at least one follow-up interview, and that's our sample for the next part of the analysis. This is the distribution of risk classes at baseline and follow-up. There was a large increase in membership in the low-risk class. At baseline, 32% were in the low-risk class. At follow-up, 69% were in the low-risk class. And there were corresponding decreases in membership in the other classes. Comparing the peer education intervention with the control, there was little difference in overall in membership in classes at follow-up. The PEI group had slightly more participants in the low-risk group at follow-up and slightly fewer in the high-risk group, but these differences were not statistically significant. However, when we look at transitions from baseline to follow-up, this graph shows the probability of being in the low-risk class at follow-up stratified by baseline most likely class and condition. And the probability for a high-risk injector in the control condition transitioning to the low-risk class was 37%, whereas it was 53% for those in the peer education intervention condition. We ran a general linear model regression using logitlink, and the odds ratio for this relationship was significant. So also the probability of remaining in the high risk for high risk participants at baseline, the probability of remaining high risk was 25% in the control group and 14% in the peer education intervention. So in summary, we identified four classes of injection risk behavior. Class membership was associated with frequency of injection, injection with others, peer norms, and self-efficacy for safer injection. Trial participation was equal across risk classes. And compared to a control group, peer education training had a significant effect on reducing injection risk behavior among young IDU with a high-risk profile. And these results suggest that targeting the peer education intervention to high-risk IDUs could be an efficient strategy. However, we don't know if there may be some group dynamics that come into play that would produce different results with a group of high-risk participants compared to a mixed group. Also, this analysis does not address the relationship between behavior change and HIV or HCV infection. We assume that high-risk behavior is more likely to lead to infection, but this analysis does not address that. And finally, the study was supported by a grant from National Institute on Drug Abuse, and I would like to thank Dr. Katie Wickwitz for her assistance with the analysis.